Test. Okay. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our live broadcast. So the Buddha's teaching is, if you've spent any time looking into it, it's quite a vast ocean of teachings and histories and stories, and there's a lot there. It can make it somewhat daunting to try and understand even the simple aspects of how to practice meditation. So there are different ways of dealing with this, of approaching the Buddha's teaching when explaining, when teaching. One of them is, and we see this in the Buddha's teaching, one of the ways is to pick one quality and talk about it at great length. So this is, we zoom in on a teaching and they're called suttas, and it's a good word, whether or not it's what it originally meant, but sutta means a thread. So the idea is that you can start from one point and you can connect it to the rest, to the whole. There are many ways of looking at Buddhism, looking at the Buddha's teaching. And there are many ways of approaching the same concept or the same idea, the same core. Another way of going about it, something that I'd like to look at today, is the idea of giving an overview of the Buddha's teaching. And as with finding a single thread, there are also many ways of looking at the entire tapestry of the Buddha's teaching. So there are many summaries, many ways of summarizing the Buddha's teaching, but I think one of the most macroscopic or all-encompassing is what the Buddha called the Bodhipakkhya Dhamma. Bodhi meaning enlightenment, pakkhya having a part. Bodhipakkhya, maybe pakkhya, I guess. Having a part in enlightenment. Why I think this is one of the most all-encompassing is because there's 37 of them. So it's a list of lists actually. It's a group of lists in total enumerating 37 dhammas, 37 aspects of the Buddha's teaching. I don't want to go into detail with these, but with each of them, but hopefully give a bit of an overview, because they're all very much related to meditation, so it gives us a good idea of the sorts of things that we're cultivating. And the best way to look at this is not to think, wow, I have to study 37 individual teachings and that's how I get a complete understanding of the practice that leads to enlightenment, but rather to understand that when we practice mindfulness, when we practice the four satipatthana, there's a lot more that comes along with it. There's a lot of great things that come along with it. Sort of help give us an idea of what it's like to practice mindfulness, or what it should be like, what should be involved, so we can have some encouragement that we're practicing properly. So the first four of these are the four satipatthana. These are the basis of the meditation practice. And these ones are obvious. This is where, if you're not incorporating these four into your practice, well, it's hard to say that you're actually practicing to become enlightened. So it has to start here. These are the ones that it should be easy to understand how this relates to our practice. We have the body. So when we watch, we watch the movements of the body, or the breath as it relates to the body, and the stomach rising and falling, for example. Mindfulness of the body, when we watch the feelings and we're mindful, or we remind ourselves this is feeling. Vedana suvedana nupasi viharati. This is pain, this is pleasure, this is calm. The reminding ourselves. This is the basis of the practice, because it puts us in a position to be able to see things objectively without judgment. It reminds us it's not me, it's not mine, it's not good, it's not bad. And it focuses our attention on objective reality. Kaya vedana jitta, the mind, focusing on the mind, and dhammas, when we focus on the hindrances or the senses or the aggregates. This is all under the four foundations of mindfulness. So this is the basis. This one is clear how this is in our practice. Should be clear. If it's not, well, this is where you have to start your learning. The second one is called the Samapatthana, the four right exertions. It's another one of the Buddha's teachings, and it also partakes of enlightenment or has a place apart. But what that means is that when you practice, well, you're cultivating these four as well. We should be encouraged that we're not just being mindful, we also have right effort. We're exerting ourselves properly. Why? How? How do we know this? Right effort is not just about pushing yourself hard or working harder and harder at something. It's about being meticulous in cultivating wholesomeness and maintaining wholesomeness. The four samapatthana, the effort to guard against unwholesomeness and to eradicate it when it's arisen. And the effort to cultivate wholesomeness and to protect it once it's arisen. So it's very much about practicing mindfulness. As I was saying, the objectivity that comes, well, that's the goodness. And the judgment, the partiality, the aversion and addiction, these are the bad that we try to do away with. So simply by being mindful, you have already right exertion. You're doing the right work. You're working in the right direction. The third is the Iddhipada. This is the third set. And there's four of these as well. So we're up to 12. The Iddhipada are perhaps a little more prescriptive in the sense that they'll make and break your practice. It's possible to practice without them, but it's not possible to succeed without them. This is a measure of our success. If you're wondering how to succeed in practicing mindfulness, well, listen up. The Iddhipada are what you need. The first one is chanda. You need to like what you're doing. Not exactly like, but you need to be content with it. Chanda is this sort of catch-all phrase that can refer to desire, but it means that you're excited or energetic about what you're doing. There's something that's pushing you to do it. If you have no interest in mindfulness, well, how can you possibly succeed, right? If it's something that, and this is what we see, you know, when you try to push mindfulness on others, or when people bring their children to come and practice, or their husbands and wives try to drag their friends into practicing, you can see, well, it's a very low success rate. The most of the time, there's no chanda involved. There's no interest in it. interest isn't something you can give to someone else. It's something that must be cultivated. So you have to ask yourself, what is worth being interested in? Is mindfulness worth being interested in? Am I interested in it? If you're not interested in mindfulness, well, that's quite a scary thing. Maybe it's time that you start evaluating your focus in life. What is it that you're interested in? Why aren't you interested in mindfulness? Second one is effort. Well, this just goes back to the second set. You need to put out effort. You need to work at it. The third one is citta. Citta means you have to keep it in mind. You have to keep your mind on the practice. If you're interested in it but you never pay attention, you never actually put your mind to it, you'll know that you won't succeed. And the fourth is vimamsa, which is sort of this discrimination, where you evaluate your practice. This is the ability to step back and correct your practice. So citta means pushing ahead, but dhamma means citta means pushing ahead, but vimamsa means adjusting. You know, not just pushing ahead all the time, but pushing ahead and then realizing you're off course and going the other direction. So seeing what you're doing wrong, the ability to see the things that you're missing, the ability to evaluate, wait a second, I'm not really being mindful here. In order to succeed, you need these four. But these come up in the practice, and they're the challenge that a meditator faces, cultivating all four of these. This is how you wrestle with the practice until you progress to succeed. The fourth and fifth set are the Indriya and the Bala. And it's the same, but different way of looking at the same five things. So we have Saddha, Virya, Sati, Samadhi, Panya. Saddha means confidence. You need confidence. Virya is effort. Sati is mindfulness. Samadhi is concentration. And Panya is wisdom. And so again, here you start to say, oh, there's a lot of things to keep in mind, but it's not really like that. The point is that when you practice again, these five come up. I've talked about this extensively, that you shouldn't try to cultivate any one of these besides mindfulness. Mindfulness is the balancing one. When you're being mindful, there's confidence. You're confident because you can see this is this. Perfect, the most perfect confidence, because you're actually knowing something. There's no belief involved. There's no logic or argumentation involved. This is this. When seeing is seeing, you can't argue with that. So you have confidence. And also that you see the way seeing works and hearing works and how the mind interacts with the body. And there's perfect confidence because you're seeing it. You're knowing it. Effort comes because just by being mindful, there's right effort already. We've talked about that. So then mindfulness, concentration, well, as well, you're focused. When you say to yourself, rising, falling, or seeing, or hearing, the mantra, the repetition and the reminding of yourself keeps you focused. And five, wisdom. Wisdom is the understanding that comes from being mindful, because when you look, you see. When you see, you know. If you want to know, you have to look. If you have to see. If you want to see, you have to look. Look, see, know. This is the progression, the order of progression. But you can't look and not see, and you can't see and not know. It's sufficient to see and sufficient to look. So you don't have to go looking, is this true, is that true? Where is impermanence, where is suffering? If you look, you'll see it. So these are the Indriya. We all have these faculties. Bala refers to the power. So the Buddha separated these out. When we talked about Indriya, he would talk about the people's different levels of these things and how they can become imbalanced. But Bala means the power. These are when they are well balanced. So he would talk about these when he talked about the qualities of an enlightened being or a powerful meditator. They have these five powers based on the faculties. It's the same five. So we add another 10 and we get 22. The next set is called the Bodhjhangas. And this is another use of the word Bodhi Anga or Bodhya Anga. Bodhya meaning. It's the same as the word Buddha. It means to wake up or to become enlightened or to know something. To come to know. So Anga means just the factors, or Anga actually means like a finger. Well, no, Anga just means factor, member. So the Bodhjhangas are the factors of enlightenment. A smaller list than the 37, but another useful one as well. As you can see, all of these are ways of talking about the Buddha's teaching. But they all come together as one. So the seven Bodhjhangas are again Sati. Then we have Viriya, Sati. Then Dhammavicaya, Viriya. Piti, Pasadi, Samadhi, and Upekha. So Sati starts with Sati, is mindfulness. The factors of enlightenment start with mindfulness. And then you have Dhammavicaya, Viriya, and Piti. These three are the effort-based ones. Dhammavicaya means the investigation or the learning or the seeing that comes from being mindful. Viriya is the effort, the energetic nature of being mindful. And piti is the sort of excitement or the energy, the static charge that comes from the rapture or the groove, getting into a groove, sort of, is piti. Building up the power. And then you have basadi, which means tranquility, samadhi, which is concentration again, and upeka, which is equanimity. So the second, third, and fourth, these are effort-based. The fifth, sixth, and seventh, these are tranquility-based. And effort and tranquility have to balance. If you're, this is where the Buddha, one place where the Buddha actually said you could adjust, and you should cultivate the former three if you're feeling drowsy or lazy, and you should cultivate the last three if you're feeling distracted or restless. But then he says, you know, mindfulness is what is always useful. Satincha kohang bhikkave sabbatikang vadami. Mindfulness is the one that you use. And when you use it, well, the rest do balance out just by being mindful. You can adjust them. And the Buddha does leave room for that. He says, you know, focus on investigation and effort and rapture if you're feeling drowsy. And focus on the tranquility, concentration, and equanimity if you're feeling restless. But we don't really need to go that far. Many times the Buddha would just talk about mindfulness. It's good to know, and it's good to see when you're, again, using vimamsa, to see which one is in excess or in deficiency. So you can apply mindfulness properly. Ultimately, what we're looking for is this last one, upekha. Upekha, in terms of mindfulness or practice of mindfulness, it means seeing things objectively without any judgment, seeing everything that arises simply as it is. When you stop reacting to your experiences, that's the highest state of insight meditation. It's this, the peak, the pinnacle. What we have to get to in order to become enlightened. Anyway, these seven are very much present in our practice. So there we go, we've added another seven qualities. The final eight is the Eightfold Noble Path. So this one should be very familiar to everybody. How this appears in your practice, it can often confound people. There's eight, you know, that's the most so far, it's a lot. And so you think, well, you have to study a lot and learn about all eight of these. But again, it's not really like that in a practical sense. They really do come together. The easiest way to understand how they come together is to condense them down to the three trainings. The Eightfold Noble Path in its base is really only three things. We have morality or behavior. We have concentration and wisdom. Morality, concentration, and wisdom. These are the basis of the Eightfold Noble Path. When you boil it down, that's what the Eightfold Noble Path talks about. And that's useful because in a practical sense, you don't see, oh, here's right view, here's right thought, and so on. It's not quite so clear. In practice, they sort of do all come together. It's very difficult to pick them out. Certainly, you don't see right action and right livelihood and right effort and right speech and right mindfulness, right concentration. Picking them apart is possible, but not so useful. So morality is the body and speech involved with meditation, which it's right because it's not there. You know, you're not speaking, you're not acting. And moreover, your mind is not misbehaving. It's not creating unethical acts of body or speech. And hereby unethical, we really, in an ultimate sense, mean based on defilement. So when you walk quickly or when you wander around confused, those are all expressions of an unethical mind. They're considered to be unethical actions. When you make a fist, that's unethical. When you like out of anger, when you tense up out of fear, that's unethical. These are all unethical, meaning they're unethical, meaning they cause you suffering. That's all it means. And so as you practice mindfulness, you become ethical. There's no more eating unmindfully. There's no more speaking unmindfully. Drinking, walking, standing, sitting and lying are all done mindfully. So all of our actions, and when we speak mindfully. All of this is from the practice, becoming ethical. Concentration, of course, well, that should be fairly obvious. We've already talked about it. You become concentrated. But you become concentrated on reality, which allows for wisdom to arise, the third one. Wisdom being right view and right thought. So our thoughts are right and our view is right. We have right view because we see things as they are. So the idea here is to give an overview and to help us to see that, wow, there's a lot involved, and get some, I think, some encouragement as to the greatness of the Buddha's teaching. It really did cover a lot. The Buddha really did go in depth. He didn't just give us be mindful and we have to go on faith that that's somehow the right path. No, he was quite detailed. Look, when you're mindful, there's at least 37 things. There's a lot of different things that are involved here, a lot of good that comes from it. And it's quite complete in terms of talking about the various aspects of the mind, various aspects of experience. Also can give us some, you know, it's good to go in detail like this because it maybe reminds us of some qualities of mind that we were ignoring or dismissing, that we're overlooking. So it helps us look over our practice and to see maybe what we're lacking and to adjust our practice accordingly by being mindful of things, simply by being mindful of things that we weren't being so mindful of. So there you go. A short exposition on the 37 states that partake of enlightenment. That's the Dhamma for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. there are any questions, I'll take them. No questions. We had one on the website that I think is a fairly important one. It's a difficult one to answer, but I think it's important to address. Let's go see. Okay, so it's a longish question. So I'm genuinely confused as to why I've been stuck in my practice for so many months to no avail. For this reason, I continue to seek information, though I know it is of no benefit. The main areas I believe afflict me include expectations, wanting, clinging, doubt, and a lack of concentration. I have addressed the clinging by choosing to meditate 20 minutes a day, but I still have much doubt and a severe lack of concentration whilst noting the object, and so can't resist searching for information to see what I'm doing wrong and how to get my practice to work. What measures would you recommend? Well, 20 minutes a day, first of all, is a little. So, you know, somehow you're going to have to try to increase that if you really want to deal with your cravings and clingings and so on. And your doubts. But a little more important is to adjust your practice based on these areas that afflict you. Learn to actually meditate on your problems, which is difficult. It's much easier to ignore them and meditate on ordinary things, but that ends up being actually much more difficult. You know, because as you do that, you're ignoring reality and you're not really mindful. And so they build up and build up, and they can create a real stumbling block in your practice. So the advice I give would be twofold. Is one, you have to increase your practice. If you really want, and going along with that is the understanding that these are not simple problems. Meditation isn't a switch. It's not just pulling a switch and suddenly, poof, my problems are gone. These are habits, and they're very deeply ingrained. So meditation is not magic. It's just about cultivating proper habits and overcoming or discerning that your bad habits are problematic and giving them up. So it's something that you really have to work at extensively and intensively. Those are two good words, extensive and intensive. So the best thing, if you really want advice, is to find a place to do a meditation course. Go through the intensive cultivation of mindfulness. The second aspect is And the second answer to your question is to adjust your practice, have a little bit of mimamsa to see whether you're actually being mindful of the experiences that you have, or are you avoiding them and trying to just be mindful of the easier aspects, like the objective parts. Like, are you just saying seeing, seeing, but there's already also liking of the seeing, and you're not noting the liking, for a simple example. Or you're mindful of thoughts, but you're not mindful of the fact that you're doubting or confused or so on, worrying, afraid, liking, disliking. So I hope that helps. Someone's asking to make some form of live stream available on this site or YouTube. So we have live stream audio, if I remember to turn it on. It's on right now. So you're welcome to listen to the live stream. Though in order to get this, you probably have to hear this being spoken on the live stream, which is unfortunate. So hopefully someone on the site can... Maybe I'll try to put it in the description of the YouTube video, because the YouTube video doesn't have these questions and answers in it. I thought that would be a little too much. Okay, a question about solitude. Is there an extent to which isolation can be detrimental to one's health? Yeah, if you're isolated from food or air or water, that can be detrimental to your health. That's, I think, one extent. But I don't think that's what you're asking. If what you're asking is detrimental to your, you know, being isolated from other people, detrimental to your mental health, then that, the answer is mostly no. And there's two ways I think it could be detrimental. The first is if you isolate yourself from good people, in the sense that you don't ever go to see good people or find a good teacher or spend any time with people who can help you improve, well, that's detrimental to your mental health. The other way it could be detrimental is because you you react violently or inappropriately, at least, to the results of staying alone. Right? Most of us are attached to social interaction. And not only that, but social interactions help to keep us normal, help to keep us from having to deal with ourselves, right? So there's nothing wrong with solitude, but it's dangerous, it's powerful. You know, solitude forces you to look at yourself, and there's no escape, or there's not the escape of externalizing your problems when you relating to other people or engaging with other people. It allows you to look outward rather than look inward, which avoids the problem or keeps you from having to face the problems. So solitude is something the Buddha recommended profusely and quite strongly recommended, but it's, you know, you have to have the tools. It's such a powerful thing that if you're not well equipped, it can actually, yeah, it can be to your detriment. So solitude isn't. But the craziness in our mind certainly is. And when you have to taste that and when you have to deal with it, you can go crazy being alone. A lot of people, a lot of monks that I met in the forest end up being a little bit wacky because, you know, they're not really well equipped to be alone in the forest. It's not an easy thing. The Buddha said how difficult it is to be alone, how difficult it is to be at peace in the forest. You know, we all think, well, that's silly, you know, I go off in the forest and I'm at peace, but try living alone in the forest for years without good training. It's not easy. So twofold. I mean, the one hand is that it can be dangerous because our minds are, you know, we're not well equipped to deal with our own minds. But the other one is the first answer, that there are good things that come from social interactions, that we benefit from interaction with good people. And a part of our religious practice has to be social, I think. At the very least, the social interactions with the teacher, but more commonly, the social interactions with fellow meditators and fellow Buddhists, fellow practitioners. It helps keep us on the path and encourage us, and we can discuss and support each other's practice. You're most welcome. Well, if that's it, then I'll say good night to everyone. See you all next time. Thank you for coming.